Robert Hughes, firebrand art critic. Clive James, memoirist, broadcaster, poet. Barry Humphries, savage satirist. Germaine Greer, feminist, libertarian. Exiles from Australia, all of them.
I wanted to go to a place where there was beauty. I did believe in the great Australian ugliness.
You can tow Australia out to sea and sink it for all I care.
I was a banned writer.
Part of you might have enjoyed that.
Most of me enjoyed it.
My name is Howard Jacobson, and I have a personal interest in this. The Australia they called a sleepy backwater was my brave new world.
A brave new world indeed that had such people in it. That was a grab of Howard Jacobson there. He's the host of the new television series Brilliant Creatures, which you may have caught on the ABC last week. I don't know about you, but when I heard that they were doing another TV series looking at Clive James, Germaine Greer, Robert Hughes and Barry Humphries, a sense of fatigue set in. It was like another TV show about the Whitlam dismissal, frankly. But much to my delight and surprise, I found it illuminated things that I didn't know, things I hadn't thought, and some really interesting ideas about the nature of intellectual and cultural life in this country. So we thought we'd have a chat about it today. Joining me now in the studio to discuss the program, a Melbourne-based academic Ian Britton, who wrote a book called Once an Australian, Journeys with Barry Humphries, Clive James, Germaine Greer and Robert Hughes. And we're also joined by author and television critic for the Saturday paper, Helen Razor. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Michael.
Hey there.
Hey, look, Ian, I might start with you just because you literally wrote the book on these four.
And 17 years ago. You're right. In a way, it seems like a very stale subject. But
and yet, what do you think? What do you make of the series?
Well, it's hugely enjoyable and there's some wonderful clips and so on that a book can't do. But I do come with the bias of having written a book, and I think a TV documentary, just by its very nature, can't quite have the scope or depth that a book can. Having said that, I think the TV series, in a way, while hugely enjoyable, is also rather superficial and disappointingly so, because it could engage with its own paradoxes, and it doesn't really do that. I don't think it really confronts the expatriates. It indulges them.
Oh, Ian, I'm interested in picking up on that in a moment, but I'm going to bring Helen in first. Helen, what was your impression? The Ian's work is a wonderful scholarly work, but in contrast, the TV show is able to show some fantastic hairstyles.
My opinion doesn't coincide with Ian's, but then again, probably nobody does, because he did write such an exquisite and scholarly work. Television is not going to be scholarly. I mean, it can have pretensions, and as we heard in the ABC television voiceover, it promises all of the thundering gravitas of American visions by Robert Hughes. Now, that is perhaps one moment when you're doing art criticism on television where you really can add an extra intellectual dimension. But I don't think from television you can expect much more than a moment of questioning. It's most unlike a book. Depth is barely ever possible on a primarily visual medium. I guess the other thing that it does really pose a question for me, and it was at once the least hopeless and the most hopeless moment of Australian screen I've seen in recent years, where you see Howard Jacobson, who kind of reminds me like one of those, you know, punching bag clowns.
He does have a droopy face in a kind of pleasing way.
You know, he's a very handsome man and what have you, but it's sort of rather in his manner. He allows himself to be knocked down again and again, especially by Germaine Greer. We have this really happy man, this happy Englishman, this winning man who is also a man, Booker-winning man, who keeps saying, "But don't you love Australia?" to these four people who've chosen to leave it. And they keep saying, "No, mate, I don't." There's a moment of popular critique of Australia that I think is sort of like finally possible, because they allow an Englishman to sort of offer the counterpoint that Australia was really great. So for me, there's just that moment of relief, which hardly ever happens on primetime, where we're all permitted to say, oh, and it's not so much about the four identities. For me, that's not the remarkable thing about them, even though they're all well, I think we can say, oh, not another biography about Robert Hughes. Why not? You know, I think we're overdue for another 500 biographies of Robert Hughes. But the really special thing is it's an Australian moment where we're able to say with joy and with freedom, you know, maybe the public life of this nation sucks a bit, and that's why I like it.
I think there's a couple of really interesting things in there. One is the optimism. Give us 500 more bios of Robert Hughes. And on the other hand, the paucity of public intellectual life in Australia. Ian, Helen raises a good point. I mean, there's a moment in the first episode where Jacobson's walking around Circular Quay and looking at the plaques on the ground for each of his notable writers, and he says, Australia's a country that really loves its writers.
These are precisely the paradoxes that the program doesn't explore. It presents them, but then just lets them off the hook. Another one is Australia is this torpid cultural backwater, and yet Jacobson is arriving here, finding it the most fertile, inventive place, intellectually stimulating. And yet he asked Germaine Greer one question, weren't you very well educated by those nuns and by Melbourne University? She shrugs it off and he allows her to shrug it off. Now, I do think TV can be more probing. If you compare it, say, with Kerry O'Brien's interview with Clive James, it was superb. Admittedly, it was an hour-long confrontation, but that is the medium really being able to probe in a way that I think this program, for all its delights, missed those opportunities.
I'm interested in this idea because if this is a discussion worth returning to, presumably it's worth returning to for kind of substantial, hard-hitting questions. Helen, what's your feeling? I found Jacobson a charming host. I was pleasantly surprised. I thought he was a pretty good interviewer, although not as tough as perhaps he might have been. Did you feel like this got to the heart of some of the interesting ideas?
Oh, you know, Ian makes a great point. I would not concede that, you know, Greer is like Cassandra or like Eeyore in this television program, and she contradicts him constantly. He keeps saying, but isn't Australia lovely? And she's like, no, you know, the best thing I can do with Australia is sort of lie down and be eaten by a goanna. I mean, she's absolutely vile about Australia, and I think that intentionally or unintentionally, Howard Jacobson allows a counterpoint, you know, even as he tells these flagrant lies about Australia, where we all appreciate our writers. Simultaneously, he allows his interview subjects just through like the scope of his cheer to make criticism.
Ian, I think the word criticism and a dog barks. I have a suspicion there's a caravan moving on somewhere off the back of that hill. No, I don't mind at all. Oh, look, that is a nice thing to do. Ian, I might throw to you. What's your feeling about the value of these four in particular at that period of time? I mean, it's the story's been told a number of times, not least by yourself. Are there other voices we're not hearing, other figures that we're not remembering because we hold these four in such reverence?
There are indeed. I mean, I did that book because I wanted to concentrate on them because they'd not been done in such fashion before. But even in my introduction, I suggested that there's a whole other cast of much less self-publicising, much less trumpeting expatriates in Australia who could have been interviewed, who've made an immense contribution to English cultural life. Most notably, it might be said, Clive James's wife, who's a very impressive Dante scholar, but has utterly resisted the glamour and glitz of her husband's life.
This juncture, could I say that their value inheres in their populism?
Oh, sure. No, I don't.
You know, these people are not as wonderful as they are. Hush up, puppy. As wonderful as they are, I mean, none of them are great original thinkers. I think that their real strengths, and I think we have to accept Barry Humphreys because, you know, he's an artist.
Well, he's a great original talent. He's certainly.
I mean, you know, genuinely one of the funniest people that ever lived. But so we can absolutely accept him, but their value inheres in their populism. And, I think you have to assess them differently. Germaine Greer is not Judith Butler. Clive James is hardly Michel Foucault. They're not the most significant thinkers of the 20th century, but they're very, very significant entertainers.
I don't disagree with that at all. I think that is, and I think that's why I wrote about them, because that is their distinctive, that they can have a foot in both camps.
You're listening to Books and Arts Daily on RN. I'm Michael Williams. And we're discussing Brilliant Creatures, which is on ABC TV. Did you catch episode one last Tuesday? If you did, let us know what you think of it on Twitter at RN Books and Arts, or you can text us on 0418 226576. Go on and do it and test whether I have the aptitude to actually read your text out. I'm not sure that I do. Listen, before we return to the conversation, let's hear another snippet from the show. This is a reflection, Howard Jacobson talking to Clive James about why he left Australia.
There is a phrase at the end of Unreliable Memoirs. You talk about the abundance of natural blessings that gave you the courage to leave. That's such a powerful paradox. If those blessings existed in such an abundance, why didn't you bloody stay?
Well, the language is self-conscious and rather grand, and you've put the skewer right where it belongs. Why didn't we stay? Australia felt like a little place far away. It's actually huge, it's 3 million square miles, but it felt like a little place. It felt as if you were going to do anything in the kind of fields that some of us were interested in, which is writing and acting, movies, etc., etc., painting. Then the action was abroad, and especially in Britain. And you choose Britain because Britain was easy to get to.
I'm talking to Ian Britton and Helen Razor about Brilliant Creatures. Ian, you and Helen have both touched upon the kind of populism of the four extraordinary Australians under consideration. I'm curious, how much is their Australianness a fundamental part of why they succeeded in Britain?
Well, I think this is another myth that the program doesn't really explore, which is this notion of them as these maverick egalitarians who storm the ramparts of the British class system. They themselves, of course, are ineluctably middle class and extremely privileged. They had the means to go. That is one of the reasons they went and stayed. I just think this is but look, their entertainment value was huge, and of course, television was booming in England in the 60s. They were natural presenters. They were against the image of the old BBC. So they were welcome fresh voices. Of course, that had an immense amount to do with their talent. But what is subsumed is the kind of deep intellectual compost behind that populism. And that is what's never really revealed. And it's cleverly not revealed. You wouldn't want to in the medium. But, all of them are actually extremely scholarly, extremely intellectual.
God, I hope one day to write a memoir called Intellectual Compost. I'd be quite happy with that. Helen, if I can throw to you in just the last minute or so that we've got left, I'm curious about what you think the cost of dwelling on this particular generation of thinkers and Australian personalities might be. Are we too fixated on that period of history?
I mean, I think it's sort of inevitable. We're bound to sort of fixate on the time of our birth. The people who are making television now are in their 30s and their 40s. They'll always fixate on it. And they'll sort of always fixate on the beginning of the, sort of like the peak of the modern period, just as sort of Mad Men allows people to see modernism at its peak. I think that a fascination with this generation does too. And the fact is the radicalism of the late 60s and the late 70s, not that any of these people are particularly radical. Jermaine Greer is the most intellectually radical of all of them. They're just immensely clever. I think it does us good to see the staid liberalism of today and contrast it with that incredible intellectual colour and rigour. I'm sure even Ian would agree with me on that.
Well, if I could just throw in that Sam Goldberg, Jermaine Greer's mentor at Melbourne University, once described her as a suppressed conformist, which is an interesting idea if you think of Jermaine as the exceptional radical.
I have to say, the part of that I'm not quite sure I understand is the idea that Jermaine Greer's a suppressed anything, but it's been delightful watching some of that early footage on our screens again. It's been terrific to chat to you both. Thank you so much for coming in and joining me.
I'm so sorry about Winnie the dog. She's not mine.
She's delightful.
She was probably more eloquent than both of us.
Not at all. I've been speaking with Ian Britton, a Melbourne-based academic. He's written on this Gang of Four. He's currently at work on a biography of another Australian expat, Donald Friend. And Helen Razor is the TV critic for the Saturday Paper. She's got a book coming up called A Short History of Stupid. I can't imagine it's a terribly short history. Stupid's got a decent length to it. But that looks at the topic of diminished intellectual life in popular culture and promises to be really fun.